Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many situated throughout the world, all dedicated to the same purpose, but autonomous, individually set up in localities where there are associations of free thinkers, open-minded seekers, folks who are looking for the truth of life. And finding it in the philosophy. All of the lodges around the world are actually under the umbrella of the Declaration, and you can find that on the back of our little periodical guide, and we'd like to share that with you right now. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. All the volunteers you see active around the building, including the two sitting here for panel this morning, are merely that, volunteers, folks that have independently associated themselves with that declaration and everything you can imagine to keep this building open for the public meetings is sustained by voluntary contributions of time, service, money, whatever you can imagine. If you would like to volunteer to help with the activities of this lodge, you could speak to a student who would be at the book table before or after either of the two meetings each week, and they could explain to you how to go about volunteering. That book table is open on Wednesday afternoons and Sunday mornings before and after the classes, so that if you would like to purchase something at just minimal cost to take home and use in your own home, you can do so. This is considered a birthright of all human beings, so there's no profit to be made by any of the straight line information that you'll find on that table. And additionally, if you are an electronic person and you would like to read or print the information in the privacy of your own home, you can go to various websites, ours included, the one in Phoenix, Arizona, New York, LA, and you can get into the literature itself and even be able to search by keywords in order to study what it is you're interested in. If you're not electronic, if you don't want to have things in your house, we do offer a reference library from 5:15 to 7:15 each Wednesday night. And there's always student volunteers there ready to help you to either look at something for a particular class, or if you're pursuing an individual line of study, they can help you out with that as well. On Wednesday Wednesday evenings, promptly at 7:30 until 8:30, there is a study group in which anyone that wants to participates in reading the Ocean of Theosophy, a collation of articles from the late 1800s, and then we discuss them. There's time for Q&A and an exploration of what the article actually is saying in light of Theosophy. On Sunday mornings, we have a meeting such as today. The building did open at 10:30. There was somebody at the book table. And then from 11 to 12, we have a more formal presentation. This particular May 1st, the first of the month, is the beginning of a new course of study for these more formal classes. In April, we were looking at the issue of the mysteries of mind. Now in May, we're looking at psychism and spirituality. And the talk for next Sunday, though, is a very unique and special one. On May 8th, we'll be celebrating White Lotus Day. This is a devotional kind of a meeting. It is an annual cycle in which there's a celebration of the work done by H.P. Blavatsky. So for next Sunday, please, if you would consider coming a little bit early, and sitting in quiet reflection before that meeting, that would help the folks that are doing the talks and the readings to sustain a particular tone of commemoration and celebration. There is also this particular month a unique meeting on Saturday, May 21st. This building will be open and there will be a symposium, a mini conference, if you will, lasting from 1 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. The general theme is universal themes in world religions, and those themes in world religions will be looked at from a theosophical perspective. So we will have six little talks with time, again, for Q&A in between them. It's 2.5 hours, and it is on Saturday, May 21st. So having said that, those are our announcements and certainly the declaration. And you can find more information along those lines at the book table after class this morning. Now, the first presentation for the Sundays in May, following the topic of psychism and spirituality, is actually a very high note. Our title for this morning is Buddha, the Light of Asia. And we're certainly using a title that was popularized in this particular hemisphere by Sir Edwin Arnold in a poem that was published in 1895. But Buddha, the Light of Asia, in the Eastern Hemisphere, of course, far predates 1895. As you may recall, the philosophy of Theosophy holds a few propositions. And as we consider the life of Buddha and the teachings of Buddha this morning, we can use those propositions of one source, a universal potential of all, in the human state, cycling in reincarnation and karma, and evolving in a self-actualizing process across many lives. We can use those three premises to look at the issue of the nature of what we call the heavenly man, the spiritual ray of the absolute, what it would be to be a Mahatma, a great soul, a true genius, an enlightened one. And in our cultural understanding, there are two such that we can hearken back to, the Buddha being one, the Christ being the other. And in fact, in your private study, you might even line up the Sermon on the Mount and the Dhammapada quotes and get an idea of what these two great ones were about. There's another way to look at the life of the Buddha as an allegory for any soul struggling to be free in and through the human state. And so as we look at this particular individual in history, we're reminded that we can look at this life as an allegory, but we can find assurance in the fact that there are historical references, there are factual references for the life led by this individual. There's a great deal of authenticity, if you will, outside of any organized religions of Buddhism that developed much later after his life. Gautama Siddhartha, prince of Kapilavastu, also called sometimes Sakyamuni, led a series of events in life that were documented archaeologically, in writings, in the Mahavamsa. We can find evidence of a soul who came back to the earth as one who was most victorious, very, very mighty in charity, in isolation, if you will, in silence. Most of the key days of his biography, for instance, the eighth day of the second moon in 623 of the common before the common era was his birth time. Well, that's a full moon. He was born in the 2478th year of the Kali Yuga in northeast India, or what is sometimes now called Nepal. Around his 26th birthday, if you will, he fled from that life he'd been leading in his father's palace, went into a period of isolation, and each of those dates, the birth, the flight from the palace, the significant isolation and meditation, his emergence into the public scene again by 592 in the year before the Common Era, all the way through until the point where he was around 80 when he passed from the scene, all of these major dates and turning points are done on the full moon. If there's historical evidence that all of these things are true, the student of theosophy can find symbols and analogies with which to understand the nature of the soul who we now call the Buddha. We're reminded that by karma, this soul reincarnated across times and very gradually built up the karma and the skandhas needed to get to a point where in a particular incarnation enlightenment could be achieved. And so if we look at the different kinds of skandhas that we often talk about in these rooms, the first being of the form, we know from the accordance with the family history that he was born into a noble family, that physically he was perfectly healthy and very, very beautiful by most human standards, that he was born into an Aryan tribe of Kshatriyas, warriors, that he came into a situation of tremendous wealth and power and beauty and music. And we also can find narratives of how when his mother was pregnant and carrying him, that she had a dream of a white elephant. And so we could even discuss that later today, if you would, about the meaning of the way the seers were able to speak with her and look at the signs coming and say that this one that was coming into a perfect form would have tremendous success as either an emperor or a spiritual teacher, that the perception, the skandhic perception or ability to imagine and to will would be tremendously high. His mother died when he was extremely young, about a week old, and very gradually it came to the fore that there were additional skandhic prowesses for this young child. In terms of perception, consciousness, if you will, the teachers that were hired to tutor him and the religious leaders that would come for him to study quickly found out that impacted within, he already knew everything they had to offer. And there was never a sense of arrogance, there was never an impatience or any kind of vanity on his part. Rather, he merely very quietly led a life of actions that betold of a deep character development. There is a wonderful tale that we could talk about later about an incident in which he was playing around in the woods with a cousin. It was a hunting incident, and he was able to help a swan, a beautiful bird, survive, and exhibited a tremendous amount of compassion. It was impressed within. He tended to be meditative as a very young man, and between the ages of 16 and 18, his father decided that they needed to find a wife for him and continued to build this childhood that was very beautiful, very peaceful, very musical, very graceful in every way, but very, very sheltered. He did marry a very, very lovely princess from the area, Yasodhara. She was also a Sakya girl, and he exhibited tremendous military prowess in order to win her hand. Her father had offered a contest to all the leaders in the area, and it was the Buddha who was able to calm a stallion and was able to go through the contests in order to win her hand. Eventually, even after he was a father, as he got closer to 30, maybe 26, 30 years old, he became very restless. And gradually, what we can see in the life story is this thirst for truth and a frustration with this can't be all there is. The material life just isn't what is true, and there's got to be something else. So we see this curiosity, if you will, or the nature to seek information beginning to bloom. In his travels outside of the palace, he comes in touch for the first time with aging. He'd never seen anybody age inside the palace walls. He never had seen illness and suffering or the plague as he did out in the town. He witnessed death and then became very, very aware and down in a certain way of what is suffering all about and this tremendous compassion for those who were suffering and this urge to understand the mysteries of life so that he could take better action. And so he leaves the palace, he leaves his young wife and his child, and retreats into a period of meditation and reflection. And of course, we all know the story of the enlightenment that comes sitting under the Bodhi tree.
At this time of year, around the beginning of May, Buddhists around the world and individuals in tune with and appreciative of the Buddha and the teachings of Buddha commemorate his birth. So it is fitting as a theme for us as we begin our subject of psychism and spirituality to devote this first week to consideration of his life and teachings. And as we all have listened to this brief presentation of his life, we are perhaps filled with this same sentiment as we find expressed by William Q. Judge in Letters That Have Helped Me, letter 11, where he says, "I have been rereading the life of Buddha, and it fills me with a longing desire to give myself for humanity, to devote myself to a fierce, determined effort to plant myself nearer the altar of sacrifice." so for a long time now, Buddha has been that light of Asia, that light of peace and sacrifice that has inspired and continues to inspire millions. And we need to understand that Buddha did not write anything down, as Jesus and Krishna did not write anything down. He certainly did not come to found a new religion. As a matter of fact, as we look at his teachings, it's more of a moral philosophy that for people in general is meant to be a practical guide through life, a way in which they can meet the challenges of life, but also transcend them towards a higher goal. And so he, after his enlightenment and coming back to his family, he spent the rest of his life in teaching, public teaching. But he delivered his first sermon in a place called the Deer Park at Sarnath, which is near present-day Benares. And his sermon consisted of four noble truths. Whenever we come to a meeting of theosophy, especially on the Wednesday nights, and every other week we have a presentation of the fundamental propositions. And they're presented to us as self-evident truths, things to be considered, not to be believed, but to be checked, tested, and verified for oneself. And that's the way Buddha began his sermon. He said, I'm going to present four noble truths that anyone can check, test, and verify by their personal experience. So it's not a matter of belief, but rather a question of recognition and figuring out how are you going to live your life in accordance with these truths. So the first truth is the truth of suffering or misery. All of life is full of suffering. And of course, he was including the pangs of birth, of disease, old age, and death. But it is much more subtle and pervasive than that. Not just that obvious suffering, but the general sense of feeling off balance, disconnected, and not at ease with oneself or others. The fearfulness, the uncertainty, the inner psychological suffering that people go through, not just the obvious outer physical suffering. And we can see that that is a truth of life. The second truth he wants to consider is, yes, we have to acknowledge that there is suffering, but there has to be a cause for it. And he was approaching in terms of natural causes, things that people could see and understand for themselves, not believing in any outside force or fate or gods or God that might bring them suffering. But as it is said, you suffer from yourself. And so the truth of the cause is the second noble truth, that suffering is caused by desire and by ignorance. Desire for things, passion for things, clinging to things, which by their very nature are impermanent. And as we will see, that includes just about everything in manifested existence. So, and the ignorance, and he taught that ultimately ignorance and desire as a cause of suffering go hand in hand. It's because of our ignorance that we desire the wrong things. And because we desire the wrong things, we shut ourselves out to any possibility of understanding what is true and real. And the third truth is an extension from that. If we acknowledge that there is a cause, then there has to be a way to cease the suffering. So this is the truth of cessation, that suffering can be ended if its causes are eliminated. In other words, if we eliminate desire and we eliminate ignorance. Now, in the southern system, or the so-called Hinayana schools, we see that sometimes this is taken to an extreme where the idea is to eliminate all desires of any kind, almost a kind of asceticism, which we know he did not teach. But in the Mahayana schools, as we will learn about, this idea of desire being destroyed or ceasing is the idea that one kind of desire has to be slowly transformed into another. In other words, whatever desire you have, desire is a very important principle, and it can be higher or lower. So obviously, if you cease pushing that desire in one way, it can be transformed into another. And so this Mahayana approach to the concept of desire is much closer to the theosophical one. And the fourth truth is the way. So if we are going to cease desire and ignorance, there has to be a way. And he called this the middle way. Why? Because you want to stay between the two extremes of just outright asceticism and denial of all desires and passions in life, and the other extreme would be a complete indulgence in the desire. So there has to be a middle way, and this is the Eightfold Way. And of course, we could spend classes and lectures on this Eightfold Way, but primarily the idea is right knowledge, right resolve, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Now, in order to bring that down to an even more practical level, because that can be kind of complex to keep in mind, he's distilled it down to five basic moral precepts. And he taught that if you follow these precepts, you would eliminate the causes that led to suffering in one kind of desire and ignorance. And it didn't matter whether you were a priest or a lay person, what your station, these could be universally applied. And what's so interesting about pure Buddhism in this case is one can be a participant in any religious background and find it sympathetic, in harmony with their own religious background. So his five basic precepts, as we listen to them, we'll see that a certain peculiarity. He doesn't tell us what to do. He's not presenting himself as a moral authority as what you need to do. He's saying what one should not do. And think about it. If you're going into an area, into a new country, you want the freedom to explore wherever you want to go. But you would also like somebody to tell you where not to go, where there could be danger, what to avoid, what particular woods or paths. In other words, have a good time, have fun, but watch out for these things. And so he tells us five things to not do. And that is not to lie, not to steal, not to be unchaste, not to drink intoxicants, and there was a fifth one which we didn't write down. Perhaps we'll come back, but we forgot it for the moment. But not to lie, not to steal, not to be unchaste. Pardon?
You kill.
Not
kill.
To kill. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Not to kill. Not to drink intoxicants. Not to be unchaste. Not to steal. Not to lie. Mm-hmm. So if you don't do those things, you're on the way. And what are you on the way to? Nirvana. What's the human predicament according to Buddhism? It's we're caught on this wheel of suffering through our desire and ignorance, and one keeps incarnating again and again. And the only way to release oneself and to reach that ultimate goal of nirvana or extinction of all earthly desires and attachments and is through leading the way. And so nirvana is the ultimate reality, the ultimate goal in the Buddhist life. But it's a very mysterious concept, and we'll go more into it later when we in our questions and answers when we compare these basic teachings with theosophy. Once more, in the exoteric Southern Buddhist schools, we have the idea of it being just extinction, absolute annihilation. And the reason is that publicly, Buddha did not teach anything definite about the nirvanic condition. He just said what it was not. He said, in it, he denied that we exist, but he also denied that we don't exist. He denied that we both exist and do not exist, and he denied that we neither exist nor do not exist. He had everything covered that he denied. And the point was that this ultimate reality is so different from what we understand that you can't really conceive of it. It's beyond the finite mind. You need to get out of that finite condition. It's an absolute existence. So they're called in Buddhism the four negations. But the point is, at least in the exoteric or the southern schools, not so much in the northern schools, the ultimate goal is to escape this wheel of incarnation or rebirth or suffering and ignorance and reach a state in which there is this absolute existence or extinction where there is no knowledge or awareness of those conditions. So there's much more that can be said, and some of it will be said as we go along, but we just wanted to present these few gems that have stood the test of time in the teachings of Buddha. Yes, in the back.
Well, if we can discuss nirvana. Theosophy looks at the idea of renouncing nirvana to come back to help others. So does Buddhism talk about the same thing, or do they just talk about, going into nirvana and that's it?
Okay. Well, once again, it depends on which Buddhism you're talking about. Because remember, he never wrote anything down. We have with his disciples, and through the years, over various schools developed. Now, there's a few common principles, which we may go into later, philosophical principles, which underlie all of the southern schools. And one of them is there is no soul. There is no immortal soul to reincarnate, to go into nirvana, and to come back. That's in the southern schools. So in the northern system, the Mahayana system, there is that immortal soul. So why the confusion? And we have an explanation of that given to us in Buddha's answer to Ananda. When Ananda says, well, why, when this person came to you, asked you a question and said, what is the nature of God or what is the nature of the soul? You said nothing. Why didn't you answer him? Well, if I said this, he would have believed that. If I said that, I would have supported this school. And they're all erroneous in their own way. So he preferred to say nothing at that point, at least publicly. So like Jesus, he left the mysteries of the kingdoms of heaven to his disciples, more advanced disciples. And for the public, he didn't want to confuse their mind with metaphysical arguments, but just give them practical advice that underlay all conditions. So from a theosophical perspective, nirvana, as taught also in the Northern Buddhist systems, is absolute existence in spirit, not in form. Absolute existence in the spirit. It would be like the drop returning to the ocean, the ray returning to the sun, the spark returning to the flame. It's complete emergence of the individuality in the universal, so that there's no recognition of separateness, but pure emergence in one, absolute existence in spirit. And periodically, or one can taste of that experience, but choose to come out of it in order to help humanity. And that's the basic difference between the northern and southern schools. The southern schools say that you go into that indefinitely, forever, for a long period, and may or come out at another period of evolution. The northern school said that, yes, you can go into it, but there are those who choose to renounce it, understand it, have tasted of it, but renounce it in order to help suffering humanity.
We heard just now that the similarity between theosophy and Buddhism, especially Northern Buddhism, but we've also heard that Buddhism is not theosophy, and theosophy is not Buddhism. What's the distinction?
It is often said that we can line up religions. In fact, some of the fun experiences that we have and what's coming up on May 21st is lining up religions and comparing them and seeing where they agree, where they disagree, and sifting and weighing, trying to figure out what's the eternal truth reflect it through the prism of that particular religion. So too, if Buddhism followed the life of the Buddha so that it predates the Christ by at least 500 years, what we have is a modern school of thought, a modern psychology, a modern religion. Theosophy is that root, is that oneness, is that impressed divine direct experience, the intuitive experience of what truth is. And Buddhism then would be one refraction of it.
Okay. So you referred to that idea or that statement, theosophy is not Buddhism. And that actually comes from the title of a section in the beginning of the Key to Theosophy called Theosophy is Not Buddhism. And on page 14, we just want to briefly read you the quote that HPB says that explains that. It's very short. One great distinction between theosophy and exoteric Buddhism is that the latter, represented by what we call the Southern schools, entirely denies A, the existence of any deity, and B, any conscious post-mortem life, or even any self-conscious surviving individuality in man. And it is so if we refer only to Buddha's public teachings. But the schools of the northern Buddhist system, established in those countries to which his initiated arhats retired after the master's death, teach all that is now called theosophical doctrines, because they form part of the knowledge of the initiates. So we have this idea that there is an exoteric aspect of Buddhism that we have in his public teachings, yet behind this we have an esoteric doctrine known to the initiates that is identical in its fundamentals and practically identical in its particulars to the esoteric aspects of Gnosticism, esoteric mm-hmm. Christianity, the Kabbalah, esoteric Judaism, the Hindu esoteric aspects. And we can, through our study of theosophy, see those, not that there's a common underlying ethical understanding in all these religions, but there is a common underlying philosophical thread that runs through all these different traditions, mm-hmm. that they're all based on one fundamental idea.
And there's one more thing to be added, probably. In the Theosophical Glossary, there's a wonderful statement about the Buddha, and one of the statements is this: his religion is the only absolutely bloodless religion among all the existing religions, tolerant, liberal, teaching universal compassion and charity, love and self-sacrifice, poverty, and contentment with one's lot, whatever it may be. So his teachings, which were later then taken and developed into different sects, his teachings are extremely attractive to the student of theosophy because it is this bloodless philosophy, if you will.
Yes.
So I'm just got two questions. So in the Southern school, what do they think happens to the soul then?
Well, there is no soul.
Oh.
Okay. So what is the soul? Well, one of the ideas that we see in one of the philosophical doctrines in all forms of Buddhism is that there is no self. So what we call ourselves, our personal selves, I, is an illusion. And it's illusion caused by an aggregation of bundles or attributes they call skandhas. Mm-hmm. And skandhas can relate to our bodily condition, the way we think, the way we feel, the way we sense things, the way we perceive. But all these different elements sort of come together in a bundle, and we believe we are that self. I am this person, I am that person, I have these ideas, I have those feelings. We identify it. But in itself, it has no enduring existence. Just like the filings can come together through a magnet, but you withdraw the magnet and they all fly apart again. So what, there is no soul, there is no self there to endure. What happens at death is a dispersion of these skandhas into their separate components, but because of the causes set up, cause and effect, these skandhas come back or together in another existence, form a new personality, and we have a new being who is a reincarnation of the previous being. Not because it's the same individuality, but you've set up the causes, and so now in your future life, all those skandhas are going to come back and be your next existence. So it's a reincarnation of tendencies, not a reincarnation of an enduring soul. That's in the Southern system.
Okay. And then I had another question. Mm-hmm. So I think you said one of the pillars of tenets was not to lie. So how does somebody get to that point where they're not lying, period?
Not to lie.
Practice makes perfect.
Okay. Well, he gave us some advice. He said, say what is true, say what is useful, say what is friendly. Don't utter any unpleasant truth, don't utter any unpleasant falsehood. In other words, don't be a hypocrite. And don't be a condemner, self-righteous. So say what is true, practice saying what is true, say what is going to be useful under the circumstance, and say what is friendly. But don't be a hypocrite. Don't say something nice that isn't true, or something that is true but in a harsh way.
And in order to begin to practice that, there has to be a degree of mindfulness, doesn't there? There has to be a pause before we speak. If sound is sacred, if ideas are embodied, energized things that go on forever, then that pause of thinking about what is kind, what is true, what is uplifting, what would be helpful to the other, takes some time.
Didn't he say don't mention any pleasant falsehood, not unpleasant falsehood?
Don't say any unpleasant truth.
Right.
Yeah, unpleasant, don't mention any
pleasant
falsehood. Yes.
Right, okay,
yes.
Unpleasant truth, pleasant falsehood.
Say what is true, useful, and friendly. Don't say any unpleasant falsehoods or unpleasant truths or pleasant falsehoods.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about the elephant? Can we talk about that?
The white elephant?
The
talk
white elephant.
The pink elephant in the room. Right?
No, it was white. In The Light of Asia, I was rereading the poem, and there is a tale of spirit entering his mother's bosom in the shape of a white elephant. And this is said to be an allusion to his innate wisdom, the elephant of that color being a symbol of every bodhisattva, every one of them. The seers told his mother that this baby would be a son on the basis of this dream, and that he might be very successful emperor or spiritual teacher, that there were these two paths that were available and a choice would be made by him. Okay. The quotes about right speech can be found in the Dhammapada, and you can find that in a reference library. There's also a copy on the book table. And the minor tales that are meant to teach what the character of this soul was can be found in a very pleasant form in The Light of Asia, the poem, and that book is also on the book table and in the reference library for anybody that would like to look at it.
Yes?
Is there only one Buddha?
Is there only one Buddha? The Buddha is an honorarium. It is a title that means enlightened one. And there's some of the teachings that say that this is the fourth incarnation of seven Buddhahoods. In terms of the philosophy of theosophy, the teaching is if all soul resident in the human state is radiant of that deific essence, that oneness, then the potential to become enlightened, to become a true genius, to become all that soul can express in the human state is available to each and every one of us. And we have an ancient saying, look within, thou art Buddha. So is there only one Buddha? There is only one source. Radiant from that source is a potentiality for untold myriads of the Buddha.
So in the traditions of the East, there are these records of the lives of previous Buddhas.
Right.
If we understand that term, to be one who is enlightened, a general term. It's the same way in the Gnostic, the esoteric Christian understanding of the word Christ. Christ, like Buddha, like Krishna, meaning enlightened, initiated, anointed, so that as one was developing through trials and initiation, they were Christos. And then when they reached that full enlightenment, that full initiation, they were called the Christos, or the Buddha, as the case may be. So there could be a succession. The whole idea is these are not unique individuals, unique saviors. And if we look into their teachings, we see the same idea. Krishna saying, you and I have passed through many births. I know of mine. You don't know of yours. Jesus saying, I go to my Father. You go unto yours. Greater things than I have done, you have done. Know ye not that ye are gods, and the kingdom of heaven is in. All this reference by these great spiritual instructors of humanity that the potentiality for the expression of deity in its fullness in the human form is possible. And as we learn in Theosophy, those personages that history acknowledges, such as the Buddha, such as Krishna, such as the Christ, they are representatives, like the drop of rain that precedes the storm. They are representatives of what humanity will be like in general millions of years of now through its natural cycle of evolution. So we can eventually become a race of Buddhas, if you will.
You're saying that the Buddha is the potentiality. Where lies the potency? Where does it come from?
The potentiality and the potency are one. Where comes the power that comes forth from those light bulbs? Well, it's all potential in electricity, but it becomes potent once that potential, that static electricity, is expressed through a form. And so the potentiality and the potency of electricity have one source. And so the potentiality and the potency, the expression of a Buddha, have one source, the deific principle, the divine, the one self of all. We think also, if you study the life of Buddha, you can see that does he teach that, we see his, in comparison of his life with other great saviors, the same idea of the expression of oneself.
Yes, there's a very interesting, in fact, you'll find a copy of this on the book table in the foyer for you to take home. HPB published in Isis Unveiled in 1877 a comparison of the legends of three saviors. One was Krishna, one was Gautama the Buddha, and one was Jesus of Nazareth. And when you go through the potentiality, each of these souls came into an incarnation, and the stories are almost identical. Krishna was of an era about 6,800 years before Blavatsky. Buddha, 2,540 years before Blavatsky, and of course the Christ, about 1877 years before Blavatsky. But each of them have a particular, they're from royal lines. They're brought up in and around shepherds and mendicants, that by birth and divinity they are each precocious in their own way. Their degree of wisdom that they can shine through is there from childhood on. Each story talks about the slaying of young innocents in order to try to eliminate this great one from the scene. Krishna was said to be endowed with beauty, omniscience, omnipotence from birth, produced miracles, cures, casted out demons, washed the feet of the Brahmins, and descended to the lowest regions, liberated the dead, and returned to the paradise of Vishnu. Buddha is endowed with exactly the same powers and qualities and performed similar wonders. He passed his life with mendicants, and it is claimed that he was distinct from all other avatars, having the entire spirit of Buddha in him, the entire spirit of Bodhi, if you will, while the others had but a part. And then, again, we have similar teachings with the Christ. Play back there.
Now, both Krishna and Buddha have some sort of historical record, some sort of historical evidence that they did exist. But the Jesus that, even in some theosophical books, is called the Jesus of the New Testament, is questioned. His existence, his very existence is questioned, that, you know,
Well, let's be clear. HBB says that there was an individual at that time who was a great teacher in that area. It's just that the story created about that individual, who he was, where he lived, there's no physical historical evidence for the Jesus of the Bible. And this is not something that Theosophy says. There are many modern Christian and secular scholars who also question the authenticity of the history. But that's not to say that there was not an individual around who all these stories and legends were collected. And HBB says that the Christ is one of the most significant figures in human history. But she makes an interesting comment. As the years go on, we will find even more evidence of his significance. The real being who was there, not the one, the picture that we have created for us. Even the images we have of Jesus with the flowing robes and the long hair and the beard, this is all from the same depiction as Osiris, rather, in Egypt. And the pictures of him being held in his mother's arms,
mm-hmm.
Same image we see of Isis and the mother and her child. So there is a borrowing, a collection of these different traditions that surround these individuals, just like we see in the case of the Buddha and the Krishna. The only thing is that we have documented historical evidence that tell us about the first two figures, but there is hardly any documented historical evidence, although there are some few references to an individual in that area, but not the same way it's depicted in the Bible.
Way in the back. No, it's merely the contrivance, if you will, of the Latter-day Church fathers who created this unique Savior, once and only, and that's the only path available. When we look at the other teachings, and certainly in the case of the Buddha, there is no effort made by the Buddha to say, I am anything other than an enlightened man. There's no unique, deific, sacrificial kind of savior involved with that notion. Your hand was up.
Yes, I was going to ask you, in the beginning you talked about the Four Noble Truths. Do you have any thoughts about the Eightfold Path?
The Eightfold Path is right knowledge, right resolve, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. If we look at that, what is offered is to each of us to use our free will and choice, our own divine, internal, intuitive voice of conscience to determine what it is to lead the right life, the moderate life, the do-no-harm life. We're out of time.
Okay. So next week, next Sunday then, we commemorate the life and work of HPB. So we invite you to come and attend that. And as was said before, because of the devotional and inspirational nature of the meeting, to come a few minutes earlier so we can enter it in the right tone. Meeting is adjourned.